KALW.
Studies show a lot of undocumented people just avoid going to the doctor or emergency rooms unless they absolutely have to, and that can have a real impact on people's health.
California is extending health benefits to low-income young adults regardless of their immigration status.
Advocates for expanding Medi-Cal to the undocumented community see this as a step towards universal health care.
We'll look at the state's new law and what it means for undocumented residents. Then a local singer who's blind talks about the power of music in his life.
This was a level playing field. If I could play, then I could play. You know, nobody's ever said, Stevie Wonder is pretty good for a blind guy.
And what is earthquake weather? Is it a real thing?
Some people think it's when it's hot and dry. Other people think it's when it rains.
I'm Hannah Baba, and this is Cross Currents. On January 1st, California became the first state in the country to offer Medicaid to all of its young adults, regardless of their immigration status. Under a new law, over 100,000 Californians have just become eligible for health coverage. And according to KALW's immigration reporter, Teresa Cotsarillas, this is just the latest piece of legislation in California's push for universal health care. And Teresa's here to break it down for us. Hey, Teresa.
Hey, Hannah.
So what is this law?
This law makes Medi-Cal available to all Californians under the age of 26, no matter what their immigration status is.
Okay, Medi-Cal is California's low-income healthcare program.
Exactly. It's a joint federal and state program, California's version of Medicaid. Mm-hmm. Low-income children, pregnant women, families, and adults receive healthcare for free with this program or with extremely low premiums.
Okay, how low of an income are we talking here?
Look, Bay Area families who qualify for Medi-Cal are definitely struggling. Just to give you an idea, a family of four has to make less than $36,000 a year to qualify for this kind of aid.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And before California passed this new law, did people need to be citizens to qualify for Medi-Cal?
You know, they didn't, but they did either have to be a citizen or a lawful permanent resident.
So green card holders.
Yeah, green card holders. Also, people with asylum or refugee status could get it. That obviously excludes people who don't have documents, though, and as a result, an estimated 1.5 million undocumented Californians didn't have health coverage in 2019.
Okay, so if they don't have health coverage, how do undocumented Californians get health care?
Well, California has this program called Restricted Medi-Cal, which some low-income adults can use regardless of their status, but they can only use it for very specific things, mm-hmm. pregnancy care or real emergency situations. Mm-hmm. So a lot of undocumented adults rely on county services like county hospitals or public health programs, and those services vary really widely. Mm-hmm. Fresno County, for example, has actually decided not to care for undocumented adults because they say they just can't afford it. Mm-hmm. There are also some federally funded options, health centers that are required to treat everyone, regardless of status or ability to pay. But really, studies show a lot of undocumented people just avoid going to the doctor or emergency rooms unless they absolutely have to. And that can have a real impact on people's health.
And California is trying to change that.
It is. Advocates for expanding Medi-Cal to the undocumented community see this as a step towards universal health care. Mm-hmm. Governor Gavin Newsom has vowed to make every Californian eligible for some kind of health coverage, arguing that access to health care is a human rights issue. Advocates for this reform also say that covering California's undocumented community would actually save the state money, since it would offer people access to preventative care and cut down on emergency room visits, mm-hmm. increase worker productivity, that kind of thing.
And is this the first time California's expanded Medi-Cal to this extent?
It isn't. The state's been gradually expanding who qualifies for this program over the past decade. In 2016, the state extended Medi-Cal to undocumented children who are 18 and under. That extended health care to over a million children in the state. They've also extended Medi-Cal to DACA recipients. And last year, Democratic legislators proposed that California expand Medi-Cal coverage to all undocumented adults in the state. That was actually shot down pretty quickly.
Why?
Well, legislators said the plan was just too costly. Remember, Medi-Cal is funded by both the federal government and the state. Mm-hmm. But the federal government won't cover undocumented people. So any expansion to undocumented people is going to be covered by California alone.
Okay, so are people starting to sign up?
Well, nonprofits like Insure the Uninsured Project are actually predicting that young adults might be reluctant to enroll and get these benefits.
Oh, why is that?
It's because of some of Trump's immigration policies, specifically this thing called the public charge rule.
We talked about that before, but remind us what that is.
So it's a proposed federal policy that could penalize immigrants for using certain public benefits and make it more difficult for them to eventually get their green cards. Mm-hmm. I want to stress that the public charge rule has not gone into effect, or at least not yet. As we discussed a few months ago, San Francisco and Santa Clara counties are both suing the Trump administration over this policy. And just this past Monday, the administration asked the Supreme Court to rule in the case. This rule also wouldn't apply to Medi-Cal benefits, but immigration advocates and healthcare providers say there is just so much fear and confusion around the public charge rule that immigrants might not use benefits they need just to play it safe with their status.
And not get care.
Exactly.
So if a young adult does choose to sign up for Medi-Cal, how do they do that?
If you're a young adult and you think you're eligible for Medi-Cal benefits, you can sign up online at coveredcalifornia.com. You should do it soon because open enrollment ends on January 31st. Mm-hmm. In the meantime, we should all keep an eye on Sacramento right now because Gavin Newsom just rolled out his new budget and proposed expanding Medi-Cal coverage again, this time to undocumented senior citizens over the age of 65.
All right. And we'll be following along with you. Thank you, Teresa.
Thanks, Hannah.
Teresa Katsourilis is KALW's immigration reporter. You can reach her at immigration@kalw.org. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. Singer and guitarist Graham Norwood grew up in the Bay Area during the 90s, where he taught himself how to play music. Years later, he got married and gave up on his music career. It wasn't until after his divorce that he was inspired to write new songs. Norwood spent some time in the New York scene, and now he's back in the Bay Area with his debut album, Out of the Sea. The album has a dreamy sound about the ups and downs of life. KALW's Janae Darden sat down with Graham to talk about love and living with blindness.
So what brought you to music?
I just sort of immediately was into it as a kid. You know, before I had any sort of intellectual idea of why I liked it so much, it just seemed to make me happy, and I enjoyed singing along to the radio and playing along to the radio. And then I think, you know, later I thought more about it, and I'm sure there was an element of, as a blind person, feeling like this was a level playing field. If I could play, then I could play. You know, nobody's ever said Stevie Wonder is pretty good for a blind guy.
That is true. So, I've never heard that.
I think that probably had something to do with it as well. But it's always just been very meaningful and very enjoyable and life-affirming for me.
So when you were young, a kid, were you performing at school?
Yeah, I had a terrible band in sixth grade. We were called The Legends.
The Legends.
And, I would play at talent shows and stuff. And then that became, you know, more serious bands in high school. And then it just sort of developed from there to being more of a semi-professional and then a professional thing. And it's kind of just always been there for me.
So you have a wide range of influences.
Yeah, I think music is... you can enhance any kind of feeling or any kind of emotion that you have, whether it's you're feeling sad and you want to listen to sad music, or you want to listen to something to pump you up to go out at night or whatever. And one genre of music doesn't necessarily do all that. It's a cliche that they call music the universal language, but it's pretty true in a lot of respects.
But every time I try to leave here, some inchoate call.
I got serious about adulthood for a brief period in my late 20s, and I got married, and I married a painter, and it just seemed like one of us had to do something that would bring in income. We couldn't both be allergic to money, so I decided that I was going to go back to grad school and not focus on music as a career, and I think ultimately it was not the smartest decision for me. I was a little bit adrift without playing regularly, and so I ended up getting back into it and never looked back since. After the split, I decided that I really wanted to do my own music in addition to doing the side gigs that I did.
I was interested in the title, Out of the Sea, because for a lot of people, water is calming. And I know you deal with heavy personal issues in the album. And so what does Out of the Sea mean for you?
So the last song on the album is a song called Out on the Shore. And it's this sort of extended metaphor about wading into the ocean and then walking along the bottom of the ocean and coming out the other side. And the last lyric of the album is climbing out of the sea. I didn't set out to do this explicitly, but looking back at the song, I think it was a little bit of a way for me to discuss my journey, you know, wrestling with all of the things that came up as a part of that process, and then ultimately climbing out of the sea, getting out of the you know, the most difficult part, and finding a new beachhead to start again. I feel like it's really important for me to talk about blindness, to live my life openly as a blind person, and just, you know, in some small way to kind of be an ambassador for the low vision community. I think talking about blindness and just living as a semi-public figure, you know, performing on stage and doing things of that nature, I'm the only blind person that most of my friends have ever met. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, that's true in general, that there may be as many as 3 million blind people in the U.S., but we're not that visible. And I think that lack of visibility breeds a certain amount of kind of, let's say, benign ignorance, where people just don't know what blind people are capable of because they're not, you know, they don't have a blind coworker, they don't have a blind student in their class. And so they make assumptions about what blind people can and can't do. And sometimes that comes from, you know, a very noble, good impulse, which is empathy, to try to think, well, if I suddenly couldn't see, you know, what would my life be like? But that's not an apples to apples comparison, because, you know, somebody like me, I've had 38 years to learn how to be a blind person and to figure out the strategies and, mm-hmm. you know, the ways to succeed in the world. Whereas somebody who's never been blind, you know, if they suddenly lost their vision, they would think, oh my God, I don't even know where the bathroom is.
Well, one thing that we all have in common, whether we're sighted or visually impaired, is love.
Mm-hmm.
And you,
amen.
And you definitely cover that a lot in your album. What did you learn about love just through your experiences through the split, and how does that come out in this album?
It's a painful experience to go through a divorce or a breakup. I think one thing that I learned was the importance of trying to take that experience and, you know, not just project on the other person and not just say, oh, this was 100% their fault and I'm in the clear here, but really to think, why did this happen, and what role did I play in this, and how can I improve as a person and do this better the next time? I think that was really important, you know, trying to recast the pieces of a broken relationship so that the next time around I could, you know, be a better partner and have a more successful relationship. So that was definitely something that I thought a lot about. I like the idea of, you know, having a growth mindset and feeling like you can always get a little bit better at something, whatever it might be. think sometimes we tell ourselves a lie to make it easier on ourselves that, like, actually this person was horrible. And sometimes we get in really horrible relationships. But a lot of the time, I think maybe we make it easier to just sort of caricature the other person. And something that I learned is that I don't want to live that way. I don't want to have really negative, I don't want to carry around really negative feelings about anybody, really, if I can help it. Especially not somebody that, you know, has meant a lot to me at some point in my life. There's a lot of, like, good reasons why people are just not perfectly aligned. Maybe they have different goals or something. And so I try to think about that.
It's funny because those kind of situations and that heartbreak and that growth makes for good art.
Yeah, absolutely. It's funny because I think a lot of songwriters would tell you it's way easier to write a sad song than a happy song. It's just, there's something about being upset or, you know, being sad or angry or frustrated. Like, all of those negative emotions are really, really good fodder for songwriting. And it's actually pretty hard to write a really happy song. And I think maybe we're just in this kind of post-ironic phase where, you know, just being really sincere and earnest is not that cool anymore. So it's hard to just to write a song and just be like, yeah, I'm psyched. Life's good.
When time has run its course at last, I know not where I'll be.
That was musician Graham Norwood speaking with KLW's Janae Darden. Graham's album, Out of the Sea, debuts January 31st. Go to KALW.org to learn more about it.
When day embraces the endless night, old friends have gone above. The thing I'll see in the fading light is the outline of...
This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. Next up, we've got a Hey Area short where we find bite-sized answers to questions you ask. Listener Ben Harney wanted to know, why is it called earthquake weather? KLW's Sona Avakian investigates.
Most people can tell when a big rainstorm or tornado is coming. You can just step outside and sense it. But as we know, an earthquake gives us no such opportunity. However, if you live in the Bay Area, you've probably heard the term earthquake weather.
In theory, sure. I mean, I'm a San Francisco native, so I've heard about it.
Quiet, still.
People say it's warmer and hotter than usual.
We had it for the 89 quake.
Well, there's a common myth that earthquakes occur in a particular weather. Some people think it's when it's hot and dry.
That last person you heard is geophysicist Brad Agard. He studies earthquakes at the USGS Earthquake Science Center. And to further confuse things,
other people think it's when it rains. The fact that people don't all agree on what earthquake weather is also gives an indication that there really is no such thing as earthquake weather, because earthquakes occur generally every time of year, no matter what the weather is.
Game 3 of the 1989 World Series, the Oakland Athletics against the San Francisco Giants.
Flash forward to the bottom of the fourth inning. Take.
I'll tell you what, we're having an earthquake.
Anyone remember the weather that day? On October 17th, 1989, at 5:04 p.m., the Loma Prieta earthquake rocked the Bay Area, famously interrupting a World Series game between the Giants and the A's. The high temperature that day was in the 80s, and the wind was still. Coincidence? Probably.
Well, a lot of people, when they have a significant earthquake, have very strong memories of, you know, what happened that day, what the weather was, and large earthquakes are relatively rare. It can be a coincidence that someone feels two earthquakes and the weather was similar, and so they latch on to that being earthquake weather.
Even though the 89 quake may have cemented the term in the Bay Area, the idea of earthquake weather has been around a long time, since the time of Aristotle. In fact, he thought winds trapped in caves triggered them.
It really wasn't until sort of the 1906 earthquake in San Francisco that there was a very strong tie to the fact that earthquakes occur on faults, and that it's the lateral offset on faults that radiates the seismic waves that creates the shaking we feel.
So why do we still use the term earthquake weather? Maybe that sense of predictability that we give ourselves, even if it's false, brings us a small bit of comfort.
I think it can go both ways. Sometimes people, it's comforting when it's not earthquake weather, and other people sort of may feel maybe they're a little more stressful in the type of weather that they think is earthquake weather.
But Agard says, since earthquakes can happen anytime, in any temperature, rain or shine, we should be prepared, no matter the weather. In San Francisco, I'm Sona Avakian for Cross Currents.
Sona Avakian is a fellow in the KALW Audio Academy, our journalism training program. And you can find more stories just like that at KALW.org. And make sure you're subscribed to the Cross Currents podcast on your podcast player. Well, we're off on Monday for Martin Luther King Jr. Day, but tune in Tuesday at 5. A local hospital helps its teenage patients forget about their illnesses for a night.
I'm wearing a dress that I got here at the hospital. It's a two-piece, and the top is sequined. It's bright pink, which is kind of crazy. I don't usually wear pink, but someone saw it and said that they thought it would look good on me, so I tried it on, and I like immediately fell in love, and I've gotten so many compliments.
Prom at the Pediatric ICU, Tuesday at 5 on Cross Currents. And before we go, here's some local music. This is Sunkin from Oakland. Their record release show is at the Starline Social Club tomorrow night. Today's Cross Currents team includes Julia Linus Goodman, Kristen McCandless, Troop Nguyen, Marissa Ortega Welch, and Victor Tentz. Our engineers are James Rollins, Tarek Foda, and Gabe Graben. Content manager is Shirin Adil. Our managing editor is David Boyer. Deputy news director is Angela Johnston. News director is Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet, as interpreted by Daoud Anthony. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.